From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we dispel some myths and lies about election fraud in Wisconsin. Then we talk to a voting information group about turnout in this year's election.
The fact that voter suppression is not working this year is actually the story of the 2020 election. And voter suppression tends to target young people, people of color, and low-income people. And those three groups are turning out in record-shattering numbers.
Plus, we talk with a COVID-19 caseworker who says it's more important than ever to take this virus seriously.
For people that get together, whether it's a wedding, whether it's a birthday party, whether it's Thanksgiving, I would never want to look back at that gathering and think, that's the time we killed so-and-so, or this many people got sick.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. As election night stretched into the early morning of November 4th, the election results in Wisconsin began to shift. It was something that many election observers expected. In-person voting, which is generally counted first, would favor President Donald Trump. Mail-in voting, counted later, would favor former Vice President Joe Biden. But as the tide began to turn in favor of Biden, prominent Republicans, including President Trump, began making claims of fraud. These claims run the gamut from basic misunderstandings of how elections are conducted in Wisconsin to outright conspiracy theories. Eric Litke has been keeping track of these claims for PolitiFact Wisconsin, and he joins me now to talk about them. Eric, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
As you know, there have been a lot of different claims that have been made about, you know, so-called election irregularities in Wisconsin, a lot of them coming from conservatives and some Republicans. One of them is Bill Stepien, I believe his name is, President Trump's campaign manager, who claimed that these voting irregularities have put into question the results of this election. What did he mean by that?
Well, that's something that we're honestly waiting for more detail on. That does not line up with what we have heard from the Wisconsin Elections Commission and what we've seen in all of the results so far. We've seen some of the standard slowdowns and temporary mistakes that happen in any election, but certainly no evidence of any kind of widespread fraud or errors that would in any way cast doubt on the final-ish margin that we have at this point. Of Biden leading by 20,000 or so votes.
When we think about irregularities as they pertain to our elections, what are we talking about there in general?
The things that we see most often in social media these last couple days are people looking at the turnout and then looking at the vote counts themselves, particularly since we kind of have a blow-by-blow, minute-by-minute view as these votes are tabulated on election night and into the next morning. We see people with a limited background in how these things work, making assumptions about what's proper and not, but working ultimately off of bad information or misunderstandings.
There do seem to be a lot of misunderstandings just about how elections work in general. One of the ones that jumped to my mind is the idea that Wisconsin found or dumped 100,000 votes around 4 a.m. President Trump actually made this claim as well. What is he talking about? What's that situation there?
Well, we can see in the results that the Associated Press passes on from Wisconsin that there was right around 3:30 a.m. A significant jump in the number of votes, especially on Biden's side of the tally. So there's one particular chart that was produced by 538.com that shows this jump, and people without any context claiming that this shows fraud. What it is something that was 100% expected and typical for an election. In Wisconsin, we are not allowed to start counting votes until election day. And so we have an unprecedented volume of absentee ballots, which means a lot of work for those elections officials that they're not allowed to start until that morning. So in Milwaukee in particular, there's about 170,000 absentee ballots that they had to start work on. And election officials said going into election day that this was going to be something they could not get done by the time the polls closed, that it was going to go into the wee hours of the morning. And sure enough, that's what we saw. It was about 3:30 a.m. that Milwaukee finished up their work. And we saw exactly the results ultimately that we expected and predicted out of that group. Polls heading into the election said that about 80% of absentee voters in Wisconsin intended to support Joe Biden. And we also know that historically, Milwaukee is an extremely strong place for Democratic support. So if we have a strongly Democratic group and within that, a strong Democratic group casting absentee ballots, of course that group is going to largely go for Biden, which is what we saw. So it's not fraud, that's simply when officials finish counting those legitimate votes.
To your earlier point about misunderstanding this process, I think part of the confusion is really a misunderstanding of how votes are counted in Wisconsin. Can you clarify that process? Because it really varies from county to county. How they count votes in Milwaukee is not how they count them in other parts of the state.
Certainly. So there's a lot of locations that do a more traditional approach where the ballots that come in, whether they be cast on election day or cast earlier, are counted at the polling place and then reported up the chain to the county and released to the media. However, in Wisconsin, there are 39 different municipalities that have what's called a central count. So that is bringing all of the votes that are cast from the polling places to this central location where it's kind of a single operation doing that work. So instead of the results for a city kind of filtering in polling place by polling place, all of the results for that city are reported at once that central count location finishes up their work. So that's what we saw in Milwaukee. They are a central count city. Within the 30 minutes or so after Milwaukee, Green Bay reported a similar clump when they finished their central count work. So there's really two different main approaches that you'll see, and it's going to very much change how the votes come out in terms of whether it's kind of piece by piece or whether it's all at once.
Well, maybe that speaks to this idea of the votes being kind of dumped out all at once, in part because they were released all at once.
Indeed.
Back to, I think, a similar idea, but a different claim in some ways. There's this idea that Wisconsin, quote, took a break, that election officials took a break, and then there were suddenly 100,000 votes for Biden. What are those claims based on?
Certainly not reality. The only possible break here would be in the reports of election results. We saw reports kind of throughout the day of the people who voting in person, but then the long delay while Milwaukee, for example, tabulated all of the absentee ballots. So there was no break. There was just a lot of work that was being done and a decision not to make any report of those numbers until that work was done. Election officials in Milwaukee and statewide assured voters that there were a lot of people working diligently through the night to count all those votes as soon as possible. So there's simply no basis in reality to claim that there was anyone taking a break.
You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR, and I'm talking with Eric Litke. He's a reporter for PolitiFact Wisconsin and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about some of the claims that have been circulating about election fraud here in Wisconsin. PolitiFact and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel released a list of these claims. And I think they do really represent a lot of what we've seen through social media, through conversations with people. One of these claims is this idea that it's, quote, sketchy that Milwaukeeans came out in such large support of Biden. This claim was confusing for me because Milwaukee is, of course, a Democratic stronghold in Wisconsin. Where is this claim coming from?
Well, again, it's people that are looking at numbers without any research or background knowledge of simply how the demographics work around here. The quote that we were addressing specifically compared the city of Milwaukee turnout to Milwaukee County as a whole. The city of Milwaukee, of course, is and has been a Democratic stronghold forever. Milwaukee County would include a lot of the outlying suburbs, which lean much further to the right than the city as a whole. So what we saw in this election is exactly what we would expect. And it's frankly the same thing that we saw in 2016 as well. If you look at how Hillary Clinton and Trump votes broke down then, Hillary Clinton posted a 77-18 margin in the city of Milwaukee, but only a 65-29 margin in Milwaukee County as a whole. And again, seeing the influence of those more Republican-leaning outlying areas.
Yeah, for people who know the area and of course, report on the area, I don't think that was that surprising.
Right.
Now, one of the biggest pieces of misinformation, and something that's not a unique claim to Wisconsin, is the idea that the state has more votes than people who are registered to vote. And I'd like to take a step back and look at how that would even be possible. Is it possible for the state to have more votes than registered voters?
Well, this is, of course, brought up in the context of voter fraud. And so the basics of the claim is someone is asserting this, saying, well, look, they're so obviously manufacturing, making up ballots that they have registered more votes than there could have possibly been voters. That simply doesn't line up, though, with what the actual voter registration and voter tallies were in Wisconsin.
Is it an issue of not understanding how registration works in the state?
That's certainly a big part of it. So Wisconsin is one of 19 states that has same-day voter registration. So there's the first mistake is that we see people comparing the pre-election voter registration numbers to the number of votes that were cast on election day. That number of people who have voted is going to change a lot on election day. In 2016, we saw that about 13% of the voters registered on election day. So that number is going to jump. The other piece of this is that we see people that are using simply the wrong numbers to gauge turnout. So in a state with same-day registration, turnout is always calculated by dividing the number of votes cast by the total number of eligible voters in the state. So there we're not looking at registered voters, we're just looking at adults. And if we look at those numbers, we see that turnout in 2020 was very consistent with what we've had in the prior presidential elections. It actually wasn't even a record. It was up big from 2016, but 2004 saw a higher turnout percentage than we saw this year.
This last one, it's really a conspiracy theory that's gained some steam, specifically this idea that Democratic governors stepped in to stop vote counting and the so-called media created this Biden win. In order for that to be true, what would need to happen?
Well, that's exactly the right question, and that's where pretty much every conspiracy falls so horribly short. In order for something like, a Democratic governor is getting together to stop the vote and the media getting this together, you have to assume that the hundreds of media outlets that are competing against each other are instead actually working together in some kind of coordinated fashion, that all of the political elected officials like governors and all of the simple government workers like in elections commission at local levels of government, poll worker volunteers, all these people would have to be in on it, and none of them would have to raise a red flag and say, I don't think we should be doing this. You know, we're talking, even just in Wisconsin, tens of thousands, if not more, people that would have to be involved on a conspiracy of this scale, which is just certainly fails the most basic logical tests.
Well, especially when a bunch of them are journalists in this case, which, not to sell us out, but we're not great at keeping secrets.
Right. That would be a heck of a scoop, right? If there was this grand conspiracy to steal the election, like you could build a career off of that. I don't know why we would all be quiet if that was something that was actually happening.
Right. As we're looking at these claims, I think people are seeing them coming from a variety of places, but generally, how is it being spread?
Social media is certainly the core of the issue here. There's going to be people that are going to go seek out fact checks and news accounts from reputable sources, but it's much easier to just scroll through Facebook or Twitter and see something that makes you angry, that confirms whatever you already thought of the opposite party, and just blast it out there and say, see, this proves fraud, see, this proves that. The thing is that at this juncture in history, the volume of that is just unprecedented, particularly in Wisconsin, where we have this razor-thin margin. We didn't know right away who was going to win. We've got the presidential election hanging in the balance. It's absolutely a perfect storm for misinformation. And as someone that has written on this kind of social media material for a while, I mean, there's nothing in recent years that is anywhere close to the volume of what we've seen of just the number of claims that are out there. And it really all builds around a few of these basic things that we've discussed: the concept of ballots being dumped in the middle of the night, the concept of turnout numbers being skewed or impossible somehow. But it's not a single source. It's hundreds and hundreds of people that are creating posts that misconstrue or just straight up intentionally deceive on these points. And then each of those is in turn shared and viewed tens of thousands, or in some cases, millions of times. There's just so much potential for these things to spread so quickly in this kind of environment.
Are there steps that we can take ourselves to make sure, certainly, that we're not part of the group spreading these lies, but also to help stem the flow of this?
I think it really all begins with asking the right question. So when we see something political on social media, particularly that reflects maybe what we believe already, the first question that springs to mind is, how could this be happening? And so we get this emotional response, and this is just unfortunately as far as some people process before they share, right? But really that question is several down the road. The first question is not how is this happening, it's is this happening? Because ultimately the vast majority of the misinformation we're seeing around this election is built on people who are either using the wrong numbers or are misusing the numbers, are not understanding what they actually mean in Wisconsin. So it's taking that step back to say, okay, this sounds crazy, or this sounds interesting, or whatever your first inclination is, and then do a basic Google search. Pick a key term or pick a number and search for that within reputable sources and within people that are doing political reporting, you know, within outlets that you have perceived to be fair going backwards. But it's just you've got to take that first step to say, not just how could this happen, but is this real?
Yeah. Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me today.
Thanks much for having me.
Eric Lickke is a reporter with PolitiFact Wisconsin and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering many of the misconceptions about voting in Wisconsin and erroneous claims of election fraud. Coming up, we break down the record voter turnout from Tuesday's election. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. While official election results are still being tabulated, we do know a little more about voter turnout. Milwaukeeans and Wisconsinites alike showed up at the polls in droves, by mail, through early voting, and on Election Day. It was one of the best elections for voter turnout behind the 2004 election in Wisconsin, which, unlike some states, has same-day voter registration. This policy is seen by some voter advocacy groups as a step in the right direction toward fighting voter suppression. Deborah Cleaver is the CEO of Vote America, a voter information website and organization. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about this year's election and what it means for efforts to increase voter turnout in the future.
So what are some of the things that stood out to you about voter turnout in this year's election?
Oh boy, so many things. The first one is that, as we all know, we've had record-shattering turnout this year, which is especially notable because there were so many roadblocks to participation this year, COVID being the obvious one, and then a partisan attack on the USPS being another one. And despite that, we've seen record turnout, specifically among groups who you don't usually see at the polls. Young voters just rocked it this year, turned out probably in the highest rates that we've ever seen as a country. And we've also seen really high turnout with infrequent voters. Infrequent voters are people who are already registered. They've voted in the past, but they tend to skip elections. All of this super interesting for us.
Were there any significant changes in demographics for voter turnout this year?
Yeah, I would say the young voter turnout is the thing that I'm keeping the most eye on. I know in, you know, just take Texas, which is a state that I was following very closely. As of a week ago, they had had almost six times the number of people under 30 vote as had voted in 2016. But honestly, I'm gonna need a few more days to really talk about this because ballots are still coming in and ballots are still being counted.
Right, of course. But thinking about the ballots that have already come in, have you noticed anything significant when it comes to changes in demographics for voter turnout in Wisconsin or the area around it?
I mean, sure. What we're seeing this year that we haven't seen in years past is that the electorate is actually starting to reflect the population at large. Our country is diverse. The average American is actually pretty young, but our electorate is not diverse, and our electorate skews older and whiter than the population at large. So we're starting to see the electorate actually match the population, which is significant because a more diverse electorate leads to more diverse candidates being chosen to lead, which leads to politicians who actually share the values of the people that they represent. But again, and this bears repeating, all of this is happening despite a concerted attempt to keep Americans from voting. So the fact that voter suppression is not working this year is actually the story of the 2020 election. And voter suppression tends to target young people, people of color, and low-income people. And this year, those three groups are turning out in record-shattering numbers.
You don't think voter suppression efforts are really working this year? Can you go into that a little bit more and give me some more detail?
I mean, let's say they're not working as well as they have in the past, which is why we have seen so many attempts to stop election officials from counting the ballots. I mean, yes, voter suppression works. At most this year, we're going to have 65% voter turnout, which means we will still have some of the lowest turnout of any nation with democratically elected leadership. We are so far from having acceptable turnout, but when we have 65% turnout instead of 60% turnout, that means that people are overcoming what should be insurmountable obstacles to participation. But you have to take this with a grain of salt. Is it a win? Yes. Does voter suppression still work? Yes. Are increasing numbers of people managing to vote despite that? Yes. I mean, Wisconsin, you know, your entire year has been defined by voter suppression. Earlier this year, people were forced to vote in person during a pandemic because your courts decided that a deadly airborne virus did not present a sufficient risk to voters. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled that your votes were timely if they were postmarked by Election Day and then reversed course after voting had already started. I mean, that's the definition of voter suppression.
Thinking back about the turnout and demographics, how well do you think turnout went for communities of color compared to previous elections?
Better, but not good enough. Voter suppression does not target white people. So, like, voter suppression efforts are designed to keep Black and Brown people from voting, and it does work. It just worked marginally less better this year. It was marginally less effective.
What do you think needs to be done to increase turnout for communities of color?
Let's see, automatic voter registration. When you interact with the government, not just limited to the DMV, which is the only place that currently has automatic voter registration, but every government agency, if states want, you know, people to present photo ID when they vote, that's fine as long as states provide photo ID to every citizen unsolicited. Citizens should not have to ask for it. All states should have election day registration. That's actually something that Wisconsin does, which is great. And one thing that I just find exceptionally obvious is that the deadline should be postmarked by election day, because that is something that voters can control. Mail delivery is something that voters can't control. And to give you an analogy that we are all actually quite familiar with, we all know that our taxes are due on April 15th. That is universally understood to mean postmarked by April 15th, because if they needed to actually be received by the IRS by April 15th, then the deadline would be different. Those are just some things that I can think of offhand that would greatly increase turnout. I mean, states should simply issue ID to citizens, and all states should have election day registration. And states should make sure that the number of polling places or polling centers is adequate and is based on population.
And following an election, we sometimes see a push for new legislative efforts, either to increase access to the polls, suppress it, or secure it. What are you watching out for, and are there any particular efforts you think will be made in Wisconsin or the country at large?
This postmark issue is absolutely going to go to the courts repeatedly, because again, there's a universal shared understanding what a deadline is. When the IRS says our taxes are due on April 15th, that means postmarked by. The idea that ballots need to be received by election day puts an undue burden on the voters. And since the president of the United States was so clear that they were attacking the post office to slow mail delivery to keep Democrats from voting, I think we're going to see that in the courts. I don't know if we're necessarily going to see voter ID stuff in the courts. I think voter ID is honestly less important than election day registration. One thing that we're personally prepared to sue the state of Wisconsin over is this requirement that people provide a photocopy of their ID, either with their absentee ballot request or with their voted ballot. Americans don't have photocopiers. That's patently absurd. And I definitely think that we're going to see signature requirements hit the courts, because signature matching is nonsense. Manual signatures are not unique IDs and the people and unique identifiers, and the people who are expected to do handwriting analysis, specifically election officials, would never be recognized as experts in a court of law. So the fact that we let them make these decisions and then throw out ballots is actually preposterous. So those are just some of the things.
When you look back at the efforts your group made this year to get people to the polls, how do you think you did? What are your reflections?
So we basically played a game of whack-a-mole this entire year. In March, when we realized that people were going to be sheltering in their homes probably for the rest of the year, we shifted to recruiting millions of people to sign up for vote by mail. And then when we witnessed a partisan attack on the post office, we had a shift to telling people to hand deliver ballots and then to vote early. But I would say the thing that we were most excited by, which is something that we're going to do a lot of in the future, is we realized that we realized this basically last week, 7 days ago, that 34% of the unregistered citizens could still vote on election day because of election day registration. So we poured all available resources into spreading the word about election day registration, because states don't actually have the budgets to market this. And so we had a great time doing that. We saw some really positive results from reaching out to unregistered voters and letting them know that it wasn't too late for them to cast ballots. And we are going to put a tremendous amount of time and energy and money into election day registration efforts in the years ahead. Also, I'd like to say that Wisconsin really should be commended for having election day registration, and all 50 states should have election day registration.
Yeah, I just moved to Wisconsin from Kentucky, which has some very different voter registration rules. It's quite a ways away from the actual election when you have to register your party for the primary as well as like for the general election. So it's been an interesting change.
Do you want to know why? This is actually interesting. The reason that the voter registration deadlines are often 30 days before the election is they predate computers. The last time, so when these deadlines were set, we're talking decades ago. So every person did need to register on paper, and in the clerk's office, they needed to type all of that information. Oh God, not even necessarily type, but like manually enter it into a log. So it would make sense that the voter registration deadlines would be 30 days before election day if you're talking about copying this information by hand into a log, but now we have computers. So there's absolutely no reason to have a deadline that is 30 days before the election. So states like Wisconsin that make it accessible really just say, show up at the polls with ID, we'll let you register and cast a provisional ballot, and then we should be able to confirm your identity and residency shortly, have just acknowledged that computers are a thing.
Just thinking ahead, you know, past this year's election season, as we've been calling it, what do you think you might change in your approach for the next election when it comes to registering people and getting information out?
For states that have election day registration, instead of registering people earlier in the year, we're going to focus our resources on that instead for a couple of reasons. If you register people in the summer, you have to pay to register them, and then you need to pay for GOTV. If you just focus on election day registration, it's a two-in-one activity. You register them and help them vote at the exact same time. But also, people who have taken advantage of election day registration tell other people that election day registration exists. So this is a cost-effective way for us to spread the word about election day registration. I think that's probably one of our biggest takeaways from this year, is that in the 21 states that have election day registration, we should put all of our voter registration time and money in that.
Deborah Cleaver is the CEO of Vote America, a voter information organization. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about this year's voter turnout. After the break, we speak with a COVID-19 caseworker who helped people and families diagnosed with the virus. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. While many Americans are focused on election results right now, the coronavirus continues to infect people at an alarming rate. Wisconsin has seen one of the largest increases of cases in the country, breaking infection and death records on a near daily basis. Yesterday, nearly 6,000 new cases were reported in Wisconsin. The average daily death toll in the last week has been 37 people. A couple months ago, that number was just 6 people. With so many positive cases, contact tracers are having a difficult time keeping up. But patients aren't just working with contact tracers. They're also assigned a caseworker. A caseworker is different from a contact tracer in that they're available to answer questions and concerns for patients who've been diagnosed with a disease. Anything from how to get food to their homes to when to seek medical attention. Tracy Spurko is a school nurse and recently was a caseworker for people infected with COVID-19 in the city of Milwaukee. She says the work was emotionally consuming and difficult. Spurko spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver about her experience.
The other nurses that I know that are doing it had this experience too, where your whole life becomes about COVID. And when your phone rings, because even though you're at home, people are supposed to call you between certain hours, but they call you when they need help, when they're confused, when they're not sure, when they want a confirmation. Because I can tell you there were two kinds of calls that came after hours, and one of those was, yes, you should go to the ER. You need to go to the doctor. You're very sick. Yes, that's a good decision. The other was just to listen and say, I'm sorry that's happening. I'm sorry. There's not anything I can do.
Can you elaborate a little bit on what a caseworker does? It's not a contact tracer. It's something different. Can you just describe?
The caseworker, when someone takes a COVID test and it is positive, it is sent to the health department in the city or county, whatever government entity has the health department for their address, not where they work. And then it's assigned to a caseworker who will then call them and follow up and make sure they understand how long they're supposed to quarantine, what they should do, how to be safe about being at home with other people that might not be sick or who might be vulnerable, what signs to go to the doctor. When we were able to send them some food if they needed it, because people obviously had major interruptions in their income. I mean, I've had complete families of adults that have had to quarantine, and it cut off all of the income for the family. So, and I've had entire families sick. I've had both parents in the hospital with the 18-year-old taking care of all the other children. I mean, I've had a woman call me one day because she got the food that I had sent to her. And she said that was the only good thing she had happened that week, because her father had died and her uncle was intubated, and she was fearful that her mother would be intubated because they had a birthday dinner together.
Wow, that's really intense. So you're doing this kind of work. When did you start doing it?
In May, right away in May. When they put the call out in Milwaukee, they, of course, reached out to the nurses that were in the Milwaukee Public Schools. And because it's all city here and it's a city health department, and we were trained. They have a really good training program. And, you know, contract tracers are the people who call the people who've been exposed. Or the people, it's the people that we can't get a hold of, but we have to keep calling the people who are positive for COVID, and we set the case up.
So the contact tracers call the people that may have been exposed, and you keep calling the people who have been diagnosed and get in touch with them about how they need to proceed.
You know, in one of the cases, which is a really good example, I talked to a person who had a very large gathering of relatives and from all over the country and in another state, and then returned here to Milwaukee and was positive. And they potentially had exposed double digits of people, and which meant that I was gathering the information from that person, helping them figure out what they were going to do, but then having them realize that all of these people have been exposed, including where they were physically, because it was a small town and they were a large group for the town. So all of those people would get sent to different health departments. And then contract tracers would call and say, you know, Mary Beth, you just went to this and you've been exposed. Here's what you should do. You know, and they would help them to understand what, because there's a difference between being positive for COVID and being exposed. And people don't understand that with the exposure, and because COVID is so wildly.
Silently spreading.
Oh, well, but it's wily. It doesn't, you know, you can get COVID and I can get COVID, and we're going to get completely different, you know, really different. We could present really differently. And that's why it was confusing to people. And different ages seem to get it a little differently. There's some commonalities. But helping people to understand that, and with all this misinformation and, frankly, the president saying the things he's saying, I would have people say, well, I heard. And I would have to say, no, that's science. The CDC The Wisconsin Department of Health, here's what they're saying. So it's a very different process to help people to realize that people want it. A lot of times they think they're going to be smart, and when they're told they're going to quarantine, they say, all right, I'm going to go get a COVID test. And if it says I'm negative, I don't have to quarantine. But they do, because a COVID test is only good for the day you got the test. And it doesn't mean that it wasn't incubating in you, because it's 2 to 14 to as much as 15 days, I've actually seen, for it to happen. So you can be exposed 2 weeks earlier and then get sick on your 14th day.
With what you're seeing in Milwaukee, can you describe how different it is now than it was 2 months ago, for instance?
Well, I think, you know, initially we had concentrated parts of the city that were exposed. And then it moved around the city, but it moved to almost like neighborhoods. And that's when we were still in more of a lockdown phase. And then when we started opening everything up, it just sort of exploded all over the city. But then the positive being the governor having us wear masks and the city of Milwaukee having us wear masks meant that Milwaukee went from being number one. It's moved around. The last time I looked at our ranking out of 72 counties, we were 10th, but I've seen us as low as 30. And to me, since we are the largest city, that shows me that wearing masks makes a difference. If we were able to change our amount of people getting sick by just wearing masks, even though more people were getting exposed, it makes a difference. And when you look at the counties right now that are refusing, that the people are adamant, where you have the sheriffs and you have leaders of the area saying that they don't believe it. There's these communities in Wisconsin right now that are so infected, and the hospitals, I mean, what I'm hearing on the nursing side is that the hospitals are full, that in our borders, and especially our northern Wisconsin, down to Appleton, the Fox Valley's full. Their hospitals are full.
What do you want people to know in your capacity as a healthcare provider and as someone who worked as a caseworker? What should people know about this current wave of the pandemic?
It requires us to sacrifice, meaning that we can't gather together. We can't get together. We have to, there's a saying, the three W's. Wear your mask, wash your hands, and watch your distance. It's three very basic things, and I think that's part of the reason why it's difficult. I think people would feel better if we told them they could take a magic pill every day, but we don't. We have to tell them that you have to stay away from people, and you have to continue to wear this mask that makes some people uncomfortable. But I know I've seen little kids to old people with things like COPD and respiratory failure. I've seen them be able to wear masks. Obviously, I've worked in a hospital. I've worn masks in all kinds of situations. I just never had to wear a mask when I drove my, you know, when I went to the grocery store. But I think that's the basic. There's a sacrifice if we want to get our life back. You know, a woman said to me on the phone as she was crying, because I had told her that she had COVID, and she knew that her mom was already sick, and she started to cry. And she said, we just wanted to get together. And many, many people have asked me, with Thanksgiving coming up, for Americans, we're thinking about this. What do we do for Thanksgiving? And my response is, we can't. Otherwise, look around that dinner table and think about which family member you are willing to sacrifice. And they say that's harsh, but that's the reality.
for people that get together, whether it's a wedding, whether it's a birthday party, whether it's Thanksgiving, I would never want to look back at that gathering and think, oh my gosh, that's the time we killed so-and-so, or this many people got sick. That's why it takes sacrifice. And unfortunately, sadly, I'm seeing where many of us are not willing to sacrifice. But in the end, this virus, it's not going to pick and choose. It's going to take its opportunity. And that's going to be those people who don't believe the science.
Tracy Spurko, tough words, but important information for people. So thanks for speaking about it.
Yeah, it's getting tiring. That's why I couldn't do the casework anymore, too. I just felt like COVID was everywhere. And I was getting so angry at people because they wouldn't do what they need to do.
Tracy Spurko worked as a COVID-19 caseworker for patients in Milwaukee County. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. We'll take one last break, then learn some breathing exercises to help us get through a pretty stressful week. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Joy Powers. Breathing. It's something that we generally do without thinking about it. But this election week, you may need a reminder to take an extra deep breath. When we actively concentrate on breathing techniques, it can actually reduce stress, create mindfulness, and even lower blood pressure. Amelia Toporsch is a breathwork facilitator, and she joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in a past Fit for You segment. Today, we're playing an excerpt from that interview to guide us through a couple of breathing exercises. Toporsch starts with some basics of breathing techniques.
The important part is the nostril breath. The reason behind that is so that we are able to keep that fight or flight response down. We're engaging our parasympathetic nervous system when we're breathing in through the nose. And on the other end of that, if you're inhaling through the mouth, you're creating that fight or flight response and you're starting to get that heavy breath and your body is triggered to kind of watch out. So what we want to do is breathe through the nose so that we're able to stay calm, we're able to stay cool, collected. And so utilizing that nose breath, whether we're meditating or just breathing, is super important so that we are able to keep our bodies clean, calm, and collected.
So let's go into a little exercise that we can all, I'm sure, use during this time.
Okay, so today we're going to practice a conscious breath technique, the importance being conscious. So I want you to just be an observer in your own breath. We'll change your natural breathing pattern just slightly so that your inhale and your exhale are equal lengths, okay? So this breath is going to be three-dimensional. It's going to be an inhale through the nose, an exhale through the mouth, and the breath is going to pull into the deepest part of the diaphragm, into the belly, into the chest, and exhaling the air out. One technique is a four-count breath. It's an inhale through the nose. You can count to four in your mind, and exhale for four. And an inhale for four, and an exhale for four. This conscious breath really allows you to root into your body, to bring attention to your emotional body and awareness, and also helps your body, you know, stay in its powers, know that it's safe, know that you have the breath to come to, and that everything is okay.
And so I invite you to experience the physical and mental shifts that the breath can offer each of us. You can choose to be laying down or seated. Regardless, as long as you feel comfortable, you can close your eyes, but if you're driving, please keep them open. The breath will be taken in through the nose and the exhale will be through the mouth. Okay, and the point of this breath is to pull deep inhales through the nose, down the back of the throat, into the lungs, into the belly, to the bottom of the diaphragm. And as we fill that belly deep like a balloon, we'll exhale that breath out through the mouth. Inhale through the nose. Think of three-dimensional breath. And as you fill that belly, you exhale, letting it go. I invite you to pay attention to how the body feels, how the belly moves. Are we filling the lungs? Are we filling the back of the body, the front, the sides, the belly? Are we creating a tempo that feels comfortable for us? Just notice. There's no wrong or right here. Stay conscious, stay present, and stay with your breath. And I invite you each to experience this breath for a handful of minutes until you feel like the process is complete, knowing you can always come back to this breath at any point throughout your day, whether it be needing to ground, needing to find some clarity, feeling triggering moments of anxiety, needing to decompress and de-stress from the family unit that most of us happen to be in and day out right now. Knowing that the breath is always a safe place for you to come back to, that you are capable of whatever life throws at you, and that you are creating your own set of tools in order to navigate life's ups and downs. Thank you guys so much for being here with me today. Again, my name is Amelia Toporsch. Love and support to you during these wild times. And I encourage you to always come back to the breath. Be well, be safe.
Amelia Toporsch is a personal trainer, certified breathwork facilitator, and owner of Her Milwaukee, a personal health and wellness company. You can listen to the full Fit for You segment on breathing at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Becca Schimmel join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again next week for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.